Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. The war in Gaza was triggered by tit-for-tat kidnaps and killings between Jews and Palestinians. Reporter Hagar Cohen tells a remarkable story about the lives of the Jews in the illegal outposts and their Palestinian neighbours.
Background Briefing is driving into the heart of the occupied Palestinian territories, the West Bank. It's July the 18th, the day the Israeli army launched its ground operation in the Gaza Strip. That means today is the first day of the full-blown war. And while rockets are firing not far from here into Israel, and bombs from the Israeli military are landing in Gaza, this road here feels like Eden.
And tell me, where are we going?
We're going now to Ish Kodesh. It's about 30 kilometers north of Jerusalem. That's my home. Yeah, that's a little quiet community. A little over 30 families I like calling home. And there I raise my children, five children. Out of the 30 families, we have over 100 children there.
In the driving seat, Aharon Katzoff, nicknamed AY, is in his 30s and migrated to Israel from LA to return to his homeland. He's part of a small but growing movement of far-right Jewish activists who are determined to settle the occupied territories. AY lives in an outpost called Esh Kodesh, which is not recognized by Israeli law because it's built on occupied land without approvals. AY is proud of this.
When did you move out there?
I moved there about 4 years ago. I lived in a bunch of different places, and then me and my wife were driving somewhere to check a place to live, and a friend of mine told me about Esh Kodesh. So I said, you know, we'll drive through and just to look at it, just so we could tell him that we were there. As soon as we drove in, we fell in love with the place. We're like, this is our place. This is where we have to be.
Why did you fall in love with the place?
You'll see it. It's so beautiful. You just go in, there's green everywhere. You drive through vineyards, trees, mountains, the air. And the people there are very warm, nice. It's just so kind of like how you imagine the little house on the prairie.
Did it bother you that it's, you know, in the Palestinian territories?
No, not really.
After the Six-Day War in 1967, Israel occupied the Palestinian territories. In the next few decades, Israel started to build settlements in the West Bank. Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin tried to put a stop to it in the early 90s, but it didn't work.
So are we in the West Bank yet or not?
So it's interesting you ask the West Bank. I just cannot use that term of the West Bank, because we're not on the West Bank. If anything, we're the East Bank of the Mediterranean, not the West Bank of the Jordan River. It's always been Judea and Samaria.
But why do you not like the term West Bank?
Because that's somebody who wants to kick Jews out of Judea. So instead of calling it Judea, they call it the West Bank.
It's interesting because I ask you a simple question and everything is political.
The wild Middle East.
No one knows exactly how many illegal outposts there are in the West Bank, also known as Judea and Samaria. But 10 years ago, an Israeli government report counted over 100 of them. The report said the expansion of the illegal outposts is a deliberate strategy of the Jewish settlement enterprise. But AY gets annoyed when he's reminded his home is illegal.
What am I? Where do I live? Either an illegal settlement, if we're talking a little bit left, if it's extreme left, we're an illegal outpost, right? My house and community all of a sudden turns into an illegal outpost. This is Ofra, by the way. The top of the mountain over there is a community called Amona.
The outpost Amona was found to be illegal by the Israeli High Court 8 years ago. Its Jewish residents were ordered to leave. But the Israeli government stepped in and compensated the Palestinians for their land so the settlers could stay. AY's home of Esh Kodesh was built illegally in 2000. Today, 30 families live there with plans to expand to 120. AY knows his place is illegal under Israeli law, but he also knows the government supports him.
We have zoning, for example. There's lots, there's number lots, there's legal roads to get there. We're connected to the electric company, the water company. were in the municipality. My name is written in the municipality, on my lot. Except what? It's missing a signature. So politically, Israel doesn't want to sign because they're afraid of UN countries that are going to come against them. They think that if they don't sign, they're not going to come against them. They have to figure out one day that doesn't matter what Israel does, we'll always be wrong. And because they're not signing, all of a sudden I'm an illegal outpost.
But it's interesting the position that the Israeli government puts you in. On the one hand, they refuse to sign, but on the other hand, they're not telling you to go. So it's like they're sending you mixed messages about their position.
First of all, that's a very good question. I don't like looking at his mixed messages. I always say that the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing. We have the Sar Bitachon, Minister of Defense, which he's kind of in control in our land because we're behind the green line. And then you have the Ministry of the Misrata Tashtiyot.
Infrastructure.
The infrastructure will pay for roads, will build us roads, will build us water pipes, electric company, which is a governmental company, will come, you know, lay down electric wires. So one hand definitely not just wants us to be there, but is supporting us. And then you have another hand that comes and says, hey, you're illegal, so we could destroy houses.
So how do you take it?
You know, if I'm going to start going into arguments, trying to figure out what it is, it'll never end. And here in Israel, you want something built, you just got to get up and build it.
AY is a can-do type of guy. He doesn't believe in a two-state solution. He sees the Israeli government's contradictory position on the illegal outposts as an opportunity.
Here in the Middle East, you have to be opportunist. I'm an opportunist. I'm going to take the cup and drink it while you guys keep on fighting over if it's half full or half empty. The same thing, you guys could fight. Let's do a one state, two states, three states, do this, do that. In the meantime, I'm planting grapes, I'm making wine, I'm drinking it, I'm growing a family, I'm building houses. In 10, 20 years, when you finally decide, and the other side still hasn't decided, so we'll have a big city over here.
As we drive along, AY gets a phone call from an officer in the American consulate in Jerusalem.
Alan.
Hi, Aaron, how are you?
What's going on? There's just a microphone here. We're on Australian radio listening into the conversation.
I'm on the radio right now?
There's definitely a microphone here of ABC Australian radio.
Okay, well, I just wanted to say briefly, I wanted to see if you'd be available to get together sometime. I'd like to see you before I go back to the U.S., and I'd like to introduce you to the guy who's taking my place.
All right, so first we have to make it happen. I have to see. Also, any minute now, I might be getting a phone call that'll take me to the war down in Gaza.
Because of the war in Gaza, Israel has declared a state of emergency. All army reservists, including AY, are on standby to fight Hamas in Gaza, which is around 3 hours south from where we're here now. AY is fully expecting to be called up.
Yeah, how's everything with the United States, with us? Any intel you could fill me in?
Not that I know of.
We drive deeper on road number 60 into the occupied territories. It's a violent hotspot where young Palestinians are known to throw stones and Molotov cocktails at Israeli cars. One of AY's neighbours was attacked close to here. Rocks were thrown at her car and her baby was injured. It's just now that we spot hitchhikers ahead. A month ago, close to where we are now, three Israeli teenagers were picked up and murdered. Even after this terrible crime, AY is not surprised to see them on the road.
That's the way we move around here. There are very few buses. It's hard to understand, but here in Israel, a small little country, about 8 million people.
But despite the kidnapping, the recent kidnapping?
So here is like, for example, you're waiting in line to a bank. You can look at every person. Two words, I know exactly where he's from. I know his background. You know, is he a Moroccan Jew? Is he Ashkenazi Jew? Is he from Europe? Is he American? Is he Australian? You know, I'll talk to him another two sentences. I'll for sure know a family member, a friend, somebody who went to school. We're all it's like a big family here. Oh, alert. Now missiles falling in Sderot.
Our conversation is interrupted by a notification on his mobile telling him Hamas rockets are being fired towards the southern city of Sderot.
That was a siren.
Yeah, it's of Sderot.
There's
an app on my phone, so it tells me whenever there's sirens. You can try to see, maybe we can stop for a hitchhiker here. If anybody wants to get to Shiloh, just roll your window down. Marani, Mishul says Shiloh?
Huh?
Shiloh.
Okay. In?
But you're gonna have to speak English.
Okay, so
you speak English?
English,
Yeah, we're just picking up some hitchhikers here. Where do you have to get to? Shiloh? Yeah. To Shiloh or continuing on?
Shiloh.
Yeah. Back little seat. You can put your window up.
Shiloh is a bigger settlement nearby, and the boys we pick up are the same age as the three who were kidnapped and murdered not long ago.
Where are you from now?
I come from Otniel. You know Otniel?
How old are you guys?
I am 19.
19?
17.
You're not scared about hitchhiking?
No, much. This is our life, so...
You know, but just, what, 3 weeks ago, three kids about your age were kidnapped.
But we can't stop to live.
The kidnapping and murder was widely seen as the trigger for the Gaza war. One of the boys made a desperate call to the police. The recording was soon on social media. The boy can be heard telling the police, "I've been kidnapped." And then you can hear the captors shouting at them to put their heads down. And then the sound of beating. 3 weeks later, their bodies were found dumped in an open field just north of Hebron, buried under a pile of rocks. It triggered a violent retaliation. One Israeli man and two minors kidnapped a Muslim boy aged 16 in Jerusalem, poured petrol on him and set him on fire. The war in Gaza exploded. Every time a Hamas rocket is fired into Israel, the red alert system is activated. In downtown Tel Aviv, along with 10 others, Background Briefing had to take shelter as sirens went off. The rocket attack was a surprise because Hamas had only warned there'd be bombing in the evening, not the daytime. After 10 minutes, people started joking about the sirens going on for longer than usual. A young man suggests starting up a Facebook page, and later a woman reminds everyone of a Facebook event this evening for Israelis to talk about the Hamas attacks. Back on road number 60 with AY, there's no sense of the war.
Right now is one of the safest the roads have ever been, as you can see, just open, quiet, we're driving right through, nothing's happening. I think because of, as soon as rockets start falling in Tel Aviv, everyone unites. All the left, the right, everyone, and they're like, that's it, we're fed up.
AY and his neighbours up here in the illegal outposts are not part of the mainstream. They are fundamentalist Zionists. They're a small minority, but their influence is growing. Official Israeli statistics show that the settler population has nearly tripled since 1993. In the present far-right government of Benjamin Netanyahu, nearly 10% of the members of Knesset are settlers. This political makeup has resulted in a more hardline approach towards the Palestinians in the West Bank. AY says that's why the roads are quiet.
The Arabs here, the ones that usually give trouble on the roads, they feel that. They know the vibe. They know that we're not going to play around anymore. Usually they would come throw rocks, the soldiers would come and say, go away, don't come. Arrest them, let them go. Now they know that we're not, that's it, no more games. And I hope, you know, there's a feeling now in the air that we're finally standing up to protect ourselves.
The people from AY's outpost of Esh Kodesh have been clashing with their Palestinian neighbours. AY says he'll do whatever it takes to remain in his home despite its illegal status.
And whoever doesn't believe that Jews have a right to live here, so I'm going to get up and protect my family.
He lives in a modest brick house on a hilltop with an impressive view of the vineyards and the surrounding hills.
Hey, kids.
His is one of 30 homes in Esh Kodesh. The place was named after an Israeli security guard murdered in Jerusalem by Palestinians. AY introduces me to his neighbour, Mati Bloomberg. She's not short of an opinion about her neighbours on the Arab side.
They keep on trying to kill us. Every day, all day,
This is their one and only goal. They want Israel to be Palestine with not one Jewish person alive here.
Mati migrated to Israel as a child from the US, and she's moved to Esh Kodesh with her husband and three kids because she believes God promised this land to the Jews. As we walk along, she points at a nearby Arab village.
Over here is Kutzra. This is the Arab village. It's been attacking us a lot in the last couple of years.
For a decade, relations have been getting steadily worse. The Palestinians have been trying to stop the settlers taking their land, but Mati says the land belongs to the Jews and the Muslims need to leave.
If you go back to their Quran, look in what they believe in, you could see that they actually don't, they don't really have anything here. They don't need to look for anything in Israel. They're coming here to bother us. They could go to Kahir. Kahir is their holy place.
Cairo.
Yeah.
Around this area here, there are five Jewish outposts very close to each other. The settlers hope their presence will divide the Palestinian territories and prevent the establishment of a Palestinian state.
What's this village up the top of the next hill?
It's a Jewish village, and we're very close. We could walk there. It's about a 15-minute hike since you need to go down the hill and up the hill. It's helping that we have other Jewish settlements around. It makes us stronger.
In biblical times, over 2,500 years ago, Jews lived all over Judea and Samaria, and archaeological remnants were found here, evidence of early Jewish life. 2,000 years ago, Jews fled and lived in other parts of the Middle East and Europe. Prophets stated one day the Jews would be back in the Promised Land. Mati Bloomberg believes in this prophecy.
I love Israel. I love the land. And we decided to move out here since we believe in the Jewish settlements. We want to be part of turning the hilltops into places to live and vineyards and houses, communities here in Israel.
And it doesn't bother you that it's Palestinian territories?
This is not Palestinian territories.
Mati is not alone in denying the existence of the Palestinian territories. Her next-door neighbour, Inbal, has two houses in this outpost, one for her family and another she rents out for holidaymakers. Both structures are illegal.
כל בנייה יש פה צו הריסה. ומה שקורה שאנשים פה בונים לכאורה בניגוד ל...
Every house here has an official demolition order on it. So people build here supposedly against the law. But you need to understand that all the houses in Judea and Samaria started like this, without approvals. See, what you have to do here is, first you build a house, then it becomes a fact on the ground, and then you can expand and build and develop the settlement. If we would have waited for approvals, we wouldn't have had one single house here.
Are you concerned that your house can be demolished any day?
No, I'm not scared. Sure, it requires a lot of faith to start with, but I think we're safe now, because usually when the government wants to demolish a house, they do it right at the construction stage.
And has that ever happened?
In Esh Kodesh, it's never happened. Look, our basic argument is that this land, we don't occupy our land. The land belongs to Israel, to the Jews. It's ours. And we're simply returning to our land and rebuilding our country. With the Arabs here, my question is, why are we wasting so much energy in trying to neutralize their rockets? Why not reduce their population instead? Help them relocate to other Arab countries. I mean, we're afraid to start thinking a little bit differently. I hope the Australian people won't find my responses too confronting.
Another Esh Kodesh resident, Tzviki Stork, was convicted for kidnapping and violently beating a young Palestinian shepherd. He served a 20-month sentence. Background Briefing wanted to talk to him about this, but just before Mati and I arrive at his house, we're stopped by a phone call.
Shalom. כן, מה המצב?
Tzviki's wife said they won't be interviewed and that she'll explain why later. Tzviki is the son of the fundamentalist member of Knesset, Orit Struk. Orit and the residents here don't believe Tzviki committed a crime, even though he was found guilty by an Israeli court. Here is AY.
I don't think he did anything. And this Arab who claimed that it was hurt, so he's a shepherd. And who's the one who's always in the fields? Who's the only Jew from Eshkol that he sees every day? Tzviki Struk, he's working the vineyards. I mean, you have a terrorist coming, witnessing against another Jew.
AY compares what happened to Tzviki to the injustice endured by Reuben Carter, who was convicted for a crime he never did. His story was made famous by the Bob Dylan song, Hurricane.
This is the story of Hurricane, the man the authorities came to blame. You know the song? It's just like Hurricane, you know, a hurricane in Paterson, New Jersey. You know, there was somebody murdered. They said it was a black guy in a black car. They went, they found a black guy in a black car. You know, that's how it works here right now. A settler is a settler, and the Arab is hurt. So any settler you could find and pin something to. Listen, Tzviki Struk is one story. There's a lot of stories here. Tzviki Struk is a famous one because he's married with a bunch of kids.
And he actually went to jail.
He went to jail. No, there's a lot of people who went to jail. He went to jail for a longer time.
The day that Tzviki kidnapped and beat up a Palestinian shepherd started like any other. He and his friend arrived at the vineyards, which are mostly on private Palestinian land. They discovered a couple of boys from the nearby Arab village, Kusra. They chased them. One got away, but 16-year-old Imran Farah was caught. The boy doesn't live in Kusra anymore, but his brother Omar describes what happened.
They caught him. Then they started hitting him using weapons, their hands and sticks. Then he passed out. And then after that, they carried him into the car and they took him to the settlement, Ish Kodesh. And there they continued to beat him even more. And after that, he woke up and he heard one of them tell the other, kill him. But his friend said no. So they hit him and they took him in the car and they threw him in an abandoned area. And they took off his clothes and they left him naked.
Omar's brother Imran was hospitalized and today he's well and studying linguistics at university. His story shocked the village of Kusra, but it was only the beginning. Since then, the people of Kusra have experienced regular attacks by the neighboring settlers. Abdelmajid Tawfiq Nasser's house is closest to the Jewish outpost, just 1 kilometer apart. He says he's attacked regularly.
From the moment we arrived, they've been trying to kick us out of this land. First it was every 4 or 5 days, then it's every Friday. We go and pray and then they come and start damaging the olive trees every Friday.
So why are they doing this?
They want us to leave the land and they want us to hate life. And they want to end our lives just like that. But their main objective is to kick us out of this land.
His wife remembers an attack when they were having a meal.
I was in the kitchen making tea. I said to my husband that I felt something move. The settlers came in a white car. But my husband said, let's drink tea. I was pouring it and then a man came from above, actually four. One was armed and wearing a balaclava, and one was outside and two were above. He said, let me in or I'll shoot.
They said, go to that corner and not to move or else they'd shoot. And they asked us not to move. One pointed a gun at me and the other started breaking all the windows.
One of Abu Nasser's neighbors, Hilmi Hassan, heard about the attack broadcast from the speakers of the nearby mosque.
Every time there's an attack on a house in the village, they call out in the mosque that there are scuffles. One day, the settlers attacked one of the houses in the southern side of the village, so we got out to see what happened. When we reached there, they had them trapped in a room.
As Hilmi and other residents arrived to help, suddenly they heard gunshots.
There was nothing in front of us, and all of a sudden they were shooting on us, and the settlers started throwing rocks. They were also shooting at us. One person had a pistol, and the other had a rifle. I was just thrown on the ground. I saw him, and he had his weapon drawn on me. Then I realized I'd been hit.
Hilmi was taken to a hospital in Nablus, and from there he was transported by an Israeli military jet to Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem for an operation that would save his life. There he was in a coma for a week, but police closed the case because they couldn't identify the offender. The Israeli human rights organization Yesh Din is now appealing the decision to close the case. Their spokeswoman, Reut Mor, says the police investigation was incompetent.
There was a group of settlers there. Only two of them were armed, different kind of weapons. So if you check the shell that was inside Halimi's body, you can know which one of them is the shooter because they were only two armed. And you have pictures of both of them shooting. And of course you have the evidence in the scene, but as happened in so many cases, the police arrived to the scene 2 weeks after the shooting and start to collect evidence. You have so much evidence you can use in this case, and still it was closed. Yesh Din, as we do in many of these cases, appealed. We still didn't hear about our appeal.
Are you hopeful?
No, I'm not hopeful. I know that you can't have law enforcement in an occupied territory.
The human rights organization Yesh Din has pursued nearly 1,000 complaints against Israeli settlers. They're mostly to do with property damage, like setting cars on fire, and violent offences, like shootings. Other offences include land grabs, where settlers build or plant on private Palestinian land. A staggering 90% of these complaints are not solved by the police.
You know, we see it many times when you ask soldiers. We have many cases of soldiers standing by when they see settlers attacking Palestinians. And sometimes you have a group called Breaking the Silence that take testimonies from soldiers. And they ask the soldiers, why do you stand by? Why don't you get involved? They say, what do you mean? The settlers are my people. The Palestinians are my enemy. What, I'm supposed to protect my enemy against my own people?
Yesh Din spokeswoman, Reut Mor. Kusra is an old Arab village right in the center of the West Bank between the Palestinian cities of Nablus and Ramallah. It's home to around 6,000 people, mostly farmers. The outposts around Kusra keep expanding, eating up their land. Under the rules of the Israeli occupation, the Israeli police are responsible for law enforcement. But the residents say this doesn't happen, so they're forced to defend themselves. Background Briefing has gone to meet the mayor of Kusra. Abdel Azim Ode, known as Abu Bilal, is a man in his 40s. His office has a big CCTV screen which has a continuous feed from surveillance cameras around town.
We were forced to put cameras near the streets and around shops as a community.
The men of Kusra have night patrols to protect their town.
We've been very successful in this area because in one evening up to 6 men would guard at night. Actually, sometimes it would be 60.
One day in January this year, the guards noticed a group of settlers approaching their village. Abu Bilal went to investigate.
The first thing that I saw with my own eyes was a group of Palestinians and a group of settlers. There wasn't any damage being done, but there was rock throwing on both sides, and unfortunately there were two soldiers. We have their photographs. They were around 8 meters or 10 meters away. And at this particular moment, I immediately said to the soldiers to do something. Do you want me to get you a camera so you can take photographs? Take these settlers away!
Footage that emerged from the incident shows both sides were violent. Were your people also violent towards the settlers?
Of course they were very aggressive and violent toward the settlers, because they've just been under extreme and constant pressure and being antagonized. And if you're placed in a situation where a settler or an aggressive individual, no matter who it is or what his idea is, and that person is on your field and is damaging your olives, and this attack was the 73rd one during the past 5 years. So naturally, there was a sense of anxiety.
In hindsight, do you still feel it was the best thing to do?
Look, we've been like sacrificial lambs for 5 years now. In that moment, we've been able to capture settlers in the field and in the presence of the army, and we had every opportunity to kill them, just like they are doing with our children. The people who were close to those who were killed or injured on our side were angry. I swear to you, people were pleading with me, just allow them to punch them in the face. I want to be honest here. If we allowed this to happen and all that was needed was an okay signal with our eyes to kill them, then they would have all died.
هنا كان في قيادة حكيمة إحنا لو سم أقول لك بصراحة لو إحنا سمحنا بس أيدنا في عينينا كنا لهم أوكي بقتلهم جميعهم.
What's fueling this anger is the growing number of settlers' attacks. The settlers in the outposts want the Israeli government to declare their villages legal. A small number were legitimized by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu 2 years ago, but the rest remain illegal. It's the illegal settlers that have stepped up attacks on the Palestinians because they want them to pay a price.
Price tag, you can call it some sort of branding, who started in 2008 by the settlers.
These vigilante groups are called Price Tag. Spokeswoman of the human rights organization Yesh Din, Reut Mor.
And what we see is that in a way these crimes are being very strategic. You know, we see that crimes are being taken place most of the times in private owned Palestinian land, which is close to a settlement. And then Palestinians, you know, they will go out to their land and they will be attacked first time, second time. The third time, they wouldn't go back to their land because they would be too afraid to go there. And then the settlers can take over that land. So the idea of these crimes is really putting fear into people's hearts, and in many cases we see that the result of that is people leaving these villages, these rural villages that agriculture is their main source of income in Area C, and going to the cities because they need to put food on the table, and there is no more option to put food on the table from agriculture in these areas.
So you're saying that Price Tag is effective?
Yeah, I'm saying it's very sad to say, but again, we saw that in one village, 40% of the people moved away from this village in these 10 years, and we saw that it's mainly the young people.
Some of the crimes involve violence.
People being beaten up until they lose their consciousness. We have twice or three times a month we see cases of these sorts of really harsh beating up of people in their agricultural land.
It's mid-afternoon, just before the start of the Sabbath, and Mati Bloomberg is showing me around the vineyards of the outpost where she works in her spare time. She tells me she knows nothing about Palestinian claims of violence.
So, I don't know. I never heard them saying that. No. I don't speak to them.
Mati says it's the Palestinians who are the terrorists, not the Price Tag movement. She says they're just a bunch of kids.
What do these kids do? They go and they pop a tire here and there. And they write that they want revenge. They don't want the Arabs to continue killing us. This is what makes us so dangerous.
So Price Tag, you know, Tag Mechir, can you justify it?
I could for sure understand how these people feel. And I myself could say that it's really bad feeling like this. There are people that live here surrounding you that want you dead. Price Tag, they actually, they feel like if we do this, so we'll show them that they should stop, that it doesn't pay them to keep on killing us. But It's I think that it's funny to call it a price tag. I don't think that this is the price. You kill a family with kids, and the price is not, it's not popping a tire. The price should be killing them. The price that it's worth.
Background Briefing's coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness. Research by Anna Whitfeld. Technical production this week by Andrei Shabanov. Arabic translation by Suhail Damouni. And Wendy Carlisle is executive producer. I'm Hagar Cohen.
G'day, beloved listeners. Issue 5 of White Paper is out now, and in this issue, RN's journos explore war and conflict around the world and across time. Guest writer John Bale, a fourth-generation soldier, draws on personal experience to examine Australia's relationship with its veterans. So follow the White Paper link on RN's homepage to download now for your iPad.